Hey everyone, welcome to the 13th episode of Wild True FM, recorded on the 31st of March, 2018. Wild True FM is a podcast about random, hopefully interesting tidbits from technology, programming, entertainment, and whatever other stuff we decide to throw at you. Your hosts are Kenneth Love,
Sam Rose,
and Daniel Lamond.
All right, I think it's time for our first topic. So there's been a lot of turmoil lately with things getting hacked, getting leaked, with information getting scraped by potentially nefarious organizations, right? There's been a lot of turmoil.
Yeah, I'd definitely say that's a fair amount of turmoil.
We're constantly hearing about somebody getting, you know, hacked or whatever. Oh, what was the sports thing? MyFitnessPal, right? Just had the thing where all the some millions and millions of accounts got leaked.
Yes.
Wait, I didn't hear about that. What happened?
It was just a couple days ago. The good folks over at Under Armour got their one of the most popular applications for fitness actually hacked, and I think usernames and passwords were leaked. And so if you used any of the passwords or usernames from MyFitnessPal and other websites, they sent you an email and said, hey, you should change this.
Yeah.
You should. And so that was something that happened.
Are we talking actual passwords or is it?
From my understanding, it's actually plain text.
Ooh.
Exciting stuff.
This is why you don't trust fitness clothing companies with, you know, passwords.
Yeah, security stuff.
God, that sounds really elitist to say, but yeah, I would kind of hate to think that somebody like was in charge of this that had no idea what they were doing, which is apparently the case if they were storing plain text passwords. So anyway, Thinkst is a research company, and they've recently put out a thing called Canary tokens. I say recently, I actually think it's been around for a couple of years, but it recently got brought up again in a place that I was looking, so I'm gonna share it. So you can go to canarytokens.org and you can generate a token if you want to. And the reason you would want to generate one of these tokens is you use this token when you sign up for something. So You can give all sorts of different tokens. You can have tokens that you embed into like MS Word documents. You have tokens you can embed into like a Windows folder or a unique email address or whatever kind of stuff you want to do. And then you register the token with them and you put the token into the thing that you generated it for. And then if an attacker gets that token and then tries to use it in some way, right? So they get that email address and try to email it. Or they get that Word doc and it triggers the embedded token in that Word doc. Then the good people at Thinkst will email you or message you or whatever. They'll whatever way you told them to contact you out of band, they will then contact you and let you know that that thing was compromised.
This sounds really cool. The first use case that came to mind for me, so one of the tokens you can generate is a URL. And the URL can look pretty innocent. I mean, you can make it look like a normal URL. I think it has to have the canarytoken.com, is it, at the start? So that they can actually register when it's accessed. But if, for example, let's say you want to figure out if your company is reading emails between employees, you could agree with a colleague, for example, and email them one of these tokens. And if anybody ever actually clicks on that token, you have this good signal that your employer is trying to spy on your internal communication, right?
Right.
So it's kind of like a honeypot, I think, right? Like the idea of a honeypot is some kind of trap you set for an attacker, and when they actually fall into that trap, like the idea being the honeypot is this enticing thing, and if somebody tries to take the honey, they get trapped, like the hand trapped in the honeypot. That's the imagery for it. And this feels like a very similar mechanism.
Conveniently, they actually mention honeypots at the end of the article. So
I definitely read it.
The exact right path.
Boom.
Yeah, it is definitely a honeypot. And you know, your thing about the private communication is very timely as well, because Slack just announced that they're changing the rules for when your employer can access your private messages in Slack. Because if you didn't know, your private messages are not actually private in Slack.
I did not know that. Are they, if you run a Slack organization, do you just get access to all private communications?
So I don't know all the details into that. I want to say on the free Slacks, like, so if you just have like a community Slack, like a lot of programming communities are, I don't believe anyone has access to the private messages in those. In business Slacks, I want to say that the domain owner has the ability to request messages from Slack, and they'll usually be provided with them. I don't believe they have just on-demand immediate access to them.
Okay, right. Yeah, I run a small Slack between me and a few friends, and I'm 99% sure that I can't see private messages between my friends. I haven't gone and looked, but it's never something I've seen available in like a settings menu or anything like that.
Right. It's exactly the same for me. I've got a community one that I help administer, and I'm pretty sure I have absolutely no way of seeing somebody's direct messages to someone else, but apparently that's not the way it works for corporate ones. For the paid ones, Slack just sent an email a couple of days ago detailing the changes. I skimmed it in the middle of work stuff, so I don't remember all the details, but they changed it so that it was more accessible. So if you are worried that your employer is doing that, then you could totally have the canary tokens, and you know, if anyone ever clicks on it, then you're just like, oh yep, look, they're going through our messages.
So I kind of gave myself away in that I haven't read this article in super deep, like in great detail. Let's, for example, say that I generate a URL canary token and it starts with canarytoken.com. That's a bit of a giveaway, right? Like how would you get around that? Do they let you do custom DNS stuff?
Yes, you can download a canary token's Docker image and run your own server, and you can build it from source. So then that way, if they end up blacklisting it or anything like that, you can still run your own custom one through a Docker image.
Oh, that's really cool.
Also at the bottom of the article, also they got a link to their canary tokens Docker image, and they have a link to their source, which is a GitHub page.
One of the things that I find fun is we often have a thing in tech of like somebody comes up with something and we're like, oh, well, that's not new. That's been done, you know, these 15 times, right? And they actually address that at the bottom of the article, that this isn't new. Apparently, someone brought up honey tokens in 2003. Someone else mentioned the concept back in 1994. And it's been a thing that people have done for hundreds of years with map makers or currency, putting fake details in to catch people that are copying the maps or, you know, in other ways, misusing the maps. So,
yeah, this is
it's a thing that's been around forever.
Oh man, you've touched on one of my guilty pleasures. I'm a really big John Green fan.
Okay,
and he has a book called Paper Towns, and Paper Towns is the term they give to those fake areas on maps. Yeah, so Cyclone, a guy in one of our precious Patreons, has just linked to a TED talk by John Green that talks about paper towns. We'll link it in the show notes. But the idea is that they are fake towns that do not actually exist, but map makers will put them on their maps. So if their maps were copied and
right,
they
that town shows
towns,
up,
then yeah, yeah, yeah. No, oh man, I love John Green.
But yeah, so it's again, it's not anything new. The Canary Tokens have been around since, the canarytokens.org site has been around since 2015. So it's definitely a thing that's been out there for a while, but it's a really cool idea, and it's a really neat thing to add in to maybe you feel like this site that you're signing up for is a little questionable. You're not certain that this is a place that you can trust. You know, perhaps it's biometric tracking by a clothing company. And so give them one of these tokens instead of giving them your real details, and you're in good shape. Sorry, that
speaking
that was
of companies we may not be able to trust.
Yes.
Dan, do you want to talk about Amazon?
Well, I don't know about not trusting. That seems a little
sorry.
So I recently got placed on my team at Amazon, which has been an exciting event. And by recently I mean like 12 hours ago or 24 hours ago. So
congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So I'm going to be in Seattle all summer. I was placed on the AWS builder team or builder tools team, which looks more like a DevOps team of sorts. So they build internal and external tooling for customers and for employees, obviously. So yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't kind of like mildly disappointed with my placement, largely because of the fact that my main focus is in machine learning and computer vision. And I have a decent background in that, including publications and recent work. And so that was kind of where I wanted to focus on this summer and really just build my tool set out to be very well-rounded in computer vision. And that just didn't end up happening, which is, an unfortunate side effect of going to a large company and kind of being put on a specific team. But yeah, other than that, excited to be working with Amazon. Obviously, I interviewed with Twitch last week and ended up getting rejected like the next day. So that was a thing. I interviewed with them on Monday, actually, right before I left to go to Seattle. And that was insane. Went out to Seattle this week.
Was it an intense interview process? How did it go?
I think it went okay, actually. It was a two-dimensional memoization table, essentially. And so that was interesting because you had to keep track of essentially a memoization table across all rows and all columns and take summations from max values surrounding the cell you were currently in, which is interesting. But I got through it. I got most of the way to the end. I was like 95% of the way. I think with like five more minutes, I probably could have solved it. But it ended up just not coming out in the long run. Had a good connection with the guy. He was running an ML pipeline, so he and I had a lot of discussions. He wrote a lot of Go, so obviously we got along. But other than that, I got the rejection the next day, which was fine because I had Amazon anyway. So it wasn't like a high-pressure situation. Yeah, I think that's it. I'm excited to be working for Amazon. I'm a little disappointed to see kind of some of the tweets that have been coming out of our political system recently about the nature of Amazon. Amazon runs like 44% of USPS's traffic. And so to see kind of people attacking Amazon as a company, I'm over here like, yes, I don't know why you're doing this.
Large companies will be attacked by somebody, right?
Like it's inevitable.
That happens. I suppose actually since I'm unemployed now, so I can probably
not unemployed.
My ex-employer.
Employed. I'm just not working.
I'm not. How's that say? Yeah, yeah. So I used to work for Google, and some of the things you're saying there, for example, the bit about with large companies, it's difficult to know or difficult to get placed where you want to get placed. That's definitely true inside of Google as well. I struggled at the beginning, and I also struggled trying to transfer internally, getting to somewhere where I really wanted to be, you know, like I found myself quite frequently on projects I wasn't super into, and trying to transfer internally was largely unsuccessful. Like I did actually have successful internal transfers, but finding something I really, really enjoyed was hard. And for new employees, you essentially don't get the choice. Like you get put where you get put, and there's not a whole lot that you can do about it, at least for entry level employees, which is how I went in. And yeah, like the constant stream of media outcry about how terrible you are. I imagine all of the big tech companies get that, like regardless of how great they seem on the outside, there's somebody always trying to throw a javelin at you.
Yeah.
And you just have to stay very quiet about
it. I mean, I think the biggest complaint I see is the nature of like them making $6.5 billion in profit and then not paying any taxes on it.
That always frustrates me.
To be honest,
always.
That because seems like a fair
it's not
complaint.
The tech company's problem.
So it is a fair point.
It's the political systems that tax them.
Right.
And not to get too political, but it's not at fault of the companies, usually, unless they're being genuinely illegal with their tax practices, which is not often
it's
the case.
It's not common.
It's often the case that they are using the system in the way it was designed to be used in order to pay less tax.
Right.
Not only that, but it's the company's fiduciary duty to its shareholders to maximize its profit. And so if you are paying taxes, you are going against your fiduciary duty, which is to maximize your profit for your shareholders. Yeah. And so for Amazon to essentially find loopholes and through these loopholes manage to pay $0 on $6.5 billion in profit is them doing their fiduciary duty, which they have legally signed a contract saying they will do. And if they don't do it, they can actually be sued by their shareholders because their shareholders argue that you aren't making enough profit or that you are doing things incorrectly. And so what you should really be doing is not attacking Amazon, who's just doing their fiduciary duty. You should be looking at these loopholes going, okay, how can we fix these loopholes? Because that's where the basis lies, is not with Amazon as a company, but with the legal loopholes that exist in the tax system. And so you should be really attacking that and trying to fix those loopholes rather than going after Amazon as a company. I don't think a lot of Americans understand that companies have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders and that maximizing profit is like literally the only purpose that they have. Maximize profit and sell a lot of stuff. We have a question in chat. Do we take questions from chat?
I suppose we do if you're going to bring it up.
Okay, well, yeah, we're taking it up. Too late now, he says. True. So a viewer, a patron, asks, yes. Isn't it reasonable to argue there's also an issue with the fiduciary duty? And I would say in our current capitalistic climate, with the way that the country seems to want to run, no. That as it currently exists, the United States is very focused on being capitalistic and running a very like market-oriented structure. And so as long as you are running a market-oriented structure, you are looking at a system in which the fiduciary duty for every company should be to maximize profit because people buy into the company or to generate additional revenue for their stocks or whatever and then sell them off and make money. And the only way to do that is if the company is doing its fiduciary duty to maximize profit. Now, if we were to swap our current economic system or modify it in such a way that we gain access to or that we approach our problems differently, in that case, it's a different situation. But for now, I would argue that we are largely in a position where we have to leave fiduciary duty the way it is until we fix our capitalistic society or modify it in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can agree with that. I mean, yeah, it's not Amazon's fault that there are loopholes to be taken advantage of. Now, okay, it's not all Amazon's fault, because with any large company, generally there's some part of that company that is lobbying for laws or conditions that will make things better for that company, of course. But the lobbyists aren't the ones that enact the laws, so if you expect better behavior, you have to kind of expect that from your politicians and not from the lobbies. The lobbies are always going to be terrible because that's their job.
Yeah. I mean, the goal of the lobbyist is to generate systems which are beneficial for the company for which they're lobbying. And
sure,
they do a good job in the United States, apparently, because Amazon paid $0 on $6.5 billion in profit. And so it is a situation, I think, in which we need to find a way to remove politicians from being purchased. But
yes,
an entirely different discussion.
That's completely outside of Amazon or any other company's
scope of work.
Right. Like other than companies that are professional lobbyists, Amazon has, I would assume, no real dealings with purchasing a politician.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna get into any of that. I'm not gonna say it. I'm not gonna say the things I wanna say. I'm not gonna say it at all.
That's fair. Yeah.
Keep it quiet.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Yeah. Anyway, so I've been placed on Amazon. I will be in Seattle all summer. They're paying an absolutely ridiculous amount of money. Software engineering in the United States, if we have any users from abroad or listeners from abroad, pays an absolutely ridiculous amount of money. And
or
so,
can, at least.
Correct. Yeah. If you are working for, I guess, what they're colloquially known as FANG or the Big Four, the pay for interns is very high. And so it'll be nice. I'll be able to pay off with essentially 2 months of work. I cover living and my school expenses for both of my semesters. And so then I kind of have a third month of just like discretionary spending, which is very nice. Beneficial to me as a human being. And then the tax returns are also bonkers because they tax you at a very high rate because they assume you're making this much money year round, but you're not.
Right.
And so tax returns are anywhere between like $7,000 and $13,000. So it's like a nice little...
You're going to have to wait, 9 to 10 months before you get that back, so...
True, yeah, but I'll also have roughly $15,000 in savings by the time we hit that mark. And so I should have more than enough to get through to that mark and then also take that money and then do what I want with it. So, yes, it has been a very successful internship season for me. I have roughly a 20% response rate on applications, which is exceedingly high for users from... or for students from my university. It's been very successful. So I just wanted to update the podcast listening crew that I'm going to Seattle. I'm going to be working with Amazon. It's going to be great. And so Ken lives really close by, so I might go down to Ken's place to record an episode one time.
Really close by. It's like a 4-hour drive.
So I could probably take a plane.
You can take a plane. You could take a plane, yeah.
Or I could take a train, too. Isn't there, I think, doesn't
there
Amtrak
is, yeah.
run
There's an Amtrak.
Amtrak
yeah.
Cascades?
You're closer to Mike than you are to me, though. Mike's in Tacoma. So,
oh, I could do that too. Yeah.
So the last thing we have on our list here is Sam. I think you've been doing some live streaming of coding lately.
He's making a Rust interpreter he's making a Lisp interpreter in Rust. If I remember
Lisp
correctly,
interpreter in Rust. Okay.
So that's not quite what I wanted to talk about with this item. Although I will briefly talk about that.
About your programming experience, though. What do you think of Rust?
Rust is nice. I've been reading Programming Rust because I got it in the Functional Programming Humble Bundle.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. I'm enjoying it. I think it's got a lot of great ideas. I like how restrictive it is in that it's restricting you from making a lot of mistakes. So a question came up in our chat. Rust is functional. I also had that same reaction, but I wasn't arguing because it's a book that I wanted that I got in a bundle that I wasn't expecting to see it in. So I'm pretty happy with that regardless.
Right.
I tried to write a tiny little toy Lisp interpreter in Rust, and I spent a phenomenal amount of time arguing with Rust about what type of string I had to use for stuff. It was getting very frustrating because they have string, capital S string, right, and lowercase str, mm-hmm, for the two different types of, like, I didn't know this at the time. I hadn't really dug into it, but there's, like, str, or the reference to string, is for strings that are kind of not on the heap. They're in read-only memory, right? Like, they're like string literals and immutable strings that you can't do anything right with. Then you have capital S string, the full word string, which is heap allocated strings, which you can modify and you can append to and things like that. But I didn't realize if you should really be defining your functions with ampersand str, because ampersand string can dereference to that type of string and it just makes everything way more easy. But I was trying to do it the other way around and I got very, very stuck and flustered. But other than that, it was a good experience. I managed to write a Lisp interpreter, but it just did like mathematical operations in, prefix notation. I tried then compiling it to WASM and running it in my browser, but it didn't. It just panicked. And reading WASM backtraces is hard. I don't know how to do that yet.
Sam, let's say we had an entrepreneurial listener, and they were interested in finding a Twitch stream that was both enjoyable to watch, filled with British humor, and contained programming. And one of our hosts happened to run a stream like that. Do you have any idea what URL they would navigate to in order to find that stream in particular?
I do. So it would be twitch.tv/samwho, S-A-M-W-H-O-O.
Fantastic.
Although what I would say is I don't typically do streams that are aimed at beginner programmers. So if you're looking to learn programming, I'm definitely not the place you want to end up. Speaking of which, I have recently been spending time watching other people stream code, and a stream that I've been watching a fair bit is, his Twitch handle is Lildinked, L-I-L-D-I-N-K-E-D, and he is a model that lives in New York, and he is learning JavaScript right now, and he's something like 70 days into his programming journey. He didn't know anything about coding, and he's been streaming a few hours every day trying to learn JavaScript, and okay, he's doing it in a project-based way. So he has a lot of ideas in his head that he's not been able to realize. He decided one day, like, enough was enough. He is going to try and figure out how to make his ideas real by learning all the technology involved. And it's been really entertaining watching him and how he's learning. I think the project-based approach is really good, and I've been getting involved in his chat, and occasionally he will get stuck, and I'll try and offer some advice, like, have you tried using this? Are you familiar with this function? And I think I led him a little bit astray, because one of the things he was trying to do, he's trying to come up with a website that can recommend nearby restaurants and things, and I think it's more of an exercise in learning how to call APIs than building something from his head that he thinks is a useful idea.
Right.
But to call the Foursquare API, you need to supply your client ID and your client secret. And these aren't things that you can do client side, because you'll give away your API details, right? Like your access tokens. So I thought that it would not be a huge jump.
Sam has been a little server side component. Sorry, to interrupt. You have been very active.
You're watching it back.
Yes, I am currently watching his VOD. And Sam is over here, yeah, pair programming, essentially. Sam has been very active in this chat.
So I didn't think it would be a huge step, and this is real cognitive dissonance on my part, but I didn't think it would be a huge step to go from writing client-side JavaScript to writing server-side JavaScript, having never written any server code before. Turns out I am so wrong about that. There are so many concepts that you just don't encounter if you've not written server-side code before, and I was helping him solve his immediate problems, but I think it got to such a point where it was such a different world, and he hadn't really been given the time to digest the differences he had to deal with between client and server, and it ended up with him, I think, quite lost, and me apologizing profusely and recommending that he go back a little bit and spend a little bit more time on learning what does it mean to have this client-server divide, you know, because it's not obvious that you have to communicate via HTTP and network calls and things like that. But yeah, I think it was a great learning experience for me to realize these concepts are really alien the first time you come across them. Like, do you guys remember when you were learning for the first time, like client server code, that kind of thing?
No. But that was quite a while ago. And as you get older, your memory gets worse.
Yeah. I forgot that they had servers back in the late Cretaceous, actually.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, they were pretty slow, you know. It was generally just like a couple of palm fronds being waved around, but...
Yeah, T-Rexes just kind of like chugging along and making sure that the wheel spins to generate electricity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those were the days, Ken, huh?
Oh, man. I mean, everybody had a job.
Ooh.
Wow. But no, so I've got two people that I've been mentoring, sort of, one of them. Lately. And so the one that I just recently started tutoring, he's a JavaScript programmer. He's been doing JavaScript for a long time. Ember and Angular were the two he was doing quite a bit. And he recently started doing a Django project. And he's just been horrifically lost in a lot of places. Like, he gets a lot of it because the docs are pretty good and programming's programming to some degree. But yeah, he ends up writing like way more code than he needs to. And it's interesting seeing this divide. Even somebody who understands that there's the client server separation, having to go from front end code to back end code is a big jump. And it's not that one's harder or easier than the other. It's just that they're very different approaches and mentalities to how things work. And then the other one has recently been thrown into the deep end. He's brand new to basically everything, maybe a year worth of learning. He's been recently thrown into trying to do mobile apps using React Native tying into an API. And that's just been a whole brand new world. Yeah, I don't think we get really comfortable with the things that we use or being able to pick up something new quickly. And we don't realize just how hard it is to actually... get that knowledge, get that those small wins, you know.
A whole bunch of things are just strange as well. So
yeah,
I haven't done much Node.js. It was like the blind leading the blind. I was trying to guide him through this by reading just like a little bit further ahead than he knew, and then trying to explain that. But so when you do an HTTP call from the client, you use fetch in JavaScript. But you don't have access to that on the server side. You have to use a library call of requests.
Okay.
Which to us, you know, yeah, you're like, okay. But to somebody that's not done this before, it's like, wait, what? Why?
Right. Why can't I just use fetch in the back?
One of our patrons is telling us there is a library called node fetch. Does that, I'm assuming that gives you a fetch function that works in the same way that the client side one does?
I am looking it up.
That's pretty cool. I did not know that.
Behaves just like fetch in the browser. Well.
Yeah, it says it's consistent with window.fetch.
The examples that we found recommended using requests. So trying to explain things like that. And also node by default, I was trying to not include libraries if I didn't have to. And I just tried to use the base HTTP library that comes with node to get a web server running.
Sure.
It doesn't seem to have any default built-in capability of dealing with form data.
Okay. Like pass that form data.
So he had a form in his HTML and we submitted the form, and that, like, from what I could see, and I could be wrong here, but nothing really exposed that form data to us in a nice way. Nothing, like, we couldn't really digest it. And the recommendation that everybody gives on the web is to use Express.js.
Sure.
And I really didn't want to, like, get this guy to rewrite everything because writing any of the server-side code was really quite conceptually hard and tiring for him.
How convenient you say that. Right as our patron says that Node standard library is really bare bones, Express is what you need to do anything substantial.
Well, yeah. that's part of the design of Node, right? Was that it was very bare, because JavaScript itself is fairly bare bones. Node was also fairly bare bones. Node is basically just a way to tie together middlewares to do the thing you want to do. So you end up having to pull in these other libraries or these utilities to do these more complicated things, even though you wouldn't think responding to a HTTP response or a HTTP request would be a complicated thing.
Dan has linked something I said during a stream in the chat, and I'll read it out. There's definitely a lot to get to grips with. I may have led you a bit too far down the road a bit too quickly. You may benefit from stepping back a bit, reviewing the things you do know, and figuring out where things stop making sense. And at that point, ask lots and lots of questions. And yeah, I kind of felt bad saying that. I wasn't quite sure. He seemed to be getting most of what was being said, and he was happy that the progress was being made, but it became quite evident at some point that I'd introduced way too many new concepts.
Is there any reason in particular that he's expressed just wanting to learn how to write code?
I asked that question and got the answer. He basically has a ton of ideas and would like to make them, but getting other people to make them is expensive and it never works out the way you want. And he also expressed a desire, because models are very self-aware that their career is not super long-lived. So he wants career stability after that, and he feels that learning programming gives him autonomy to make his own projects, but it would also give him this avenue to find employment if modeling stopped working out for him.
Makes sense. It is definitely one of those fields that's going to be somewhat short-lived.
But yeah, that's kind of I learned, I think, more than he did, that I need to reevaluate sometimes the advice that I'm giving, because I think it's easy to forget the things that you just take for granted, especially in programming, when we build upon so many layers and layers and layers of abstraction.
Yeah. Well, and then I don't know if he's gotten into this yet or not, but you add on all the stuff that's not programming but is still required for programming, like setting up an editor. Sure, you don't have to go all out, but you're going to want to install an editor. You're probably going to want to add some plugins for the language or languages that you're using. And then you got to deal with package managers, and you got to deal with version control if you ever want someone else to see your code. And the thing goes live, you probably want to start looking into security and analytics and, right? Like,
yeah, and.
There's
crypto and passwords and, yeah, I mean, it
right.
gets...
There's just no end to this list of things you have to at some point consider. Maybe you don't have to do them, but you have to consider them. You know, do I need, say, SendGrid for sending out emails, or do I want to just use my own Gmail or, you know, whatever?
SendGrid is conveniently located up in Denver. I have a friend that works for them.
They do cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me. Like, I've never been a web dev guy. I don't particularly care for any type of, like, front-end or back-end web development. I'm pretty much, like, machine learning, and I think DevOps will actually be really fun this summer. And that's kind of where I prefer to stay. And so for me, it's interesting to watch people do web dev, because it's not something I've ever really, like, delved into. I mean, I've messed with it on occasion, but for the most part, I start for like 3 or 4 days and I write HTML and I realize it's very repetitive, and then I have to stop because it gets very boring for me. Whereas with machine learning, I feel like there's a lot of stuff to do, whereas it's very different every time. So web dev has always been fascinating to me, because as a person who just can't stand to do it, watching other people do it is enlightening.
You mentioned just a minute ago that you're going to find DevOps very interesting. Now, as I understand it, you haven't done anything DevOps before.
Correct.
What is it about DevOps that makes you think it's going to be a field that you'll enjoy?
Because it's kind of a field in which you are guaranteed to generate things that other people will use. And as a person who previously ran a startup and generated a product and sold and shipped it, the most exciting part of that is actually making tools that other people use, or making products that other people use. And so being able to generate tools that other people use, or being able to generate internal tooling or external tooling that other people find useful, I think is going to be an exciting part of the DevOps experience. Also, downtime is not my product, Sam. Who?
you will create downtime, though. That happens.
I'm sure everybody creates downtime, though.
Can you just somewhere in your DevOps internship make it so that half the people who sign up for US East 1 actually get assigned to US West 1? Because that's
my main goal is to just delete prod like 2 weeks in.
I mean, you can do that too. That would be fun.
Yeah. Or take US West down and just watch Reddit and every major website on the planet.
But that's just it. US West 1 really rarely goes down. It's US East 1 that goes down, and that's the one that all of the like startups we all use are on. So then half the internet goes down. Just stop signing up for US East 1. Just that's everyone. Stop signing up for that.
Stop that.
Just stop.
Kenneth has spoken.
US West 1, US West 2, US East 2. Just anything but US East 1.
EU, maybe?
EU.
We exist.
There's, well.
Nah. Do you?
If you're mainly yeah. dealing with a European audience, go to the EU one. Yeah. But just
on that
stop.
Note, though, as we were talking about Ken mentoring people earlier, Ken's mentees, I believe, are still looking for work or are looking to get involved. Ken, if I saw your tweet correctly, one of them is, yeah.
He's still looking.
So if you have work for a junior Python developer,
yeah,
and you listen to our podcast and would like one of Ken's mentees to be a part of your team, feel free to reach out to us. And on our site, you can send submissions and stuff. And so if you would like Ken's mentee to be a part of your team for junior Python stuff, let us know. Drop us a line.
You know, I really appreciate how much you got to rep me all the time. Good job.
Well, I just rep Sam, too. I mean, Sam said some pretty rude things
Sam
to
who.
Me last
it's
week.
It's Sam who, dude.
Yeah. Sam who.
Sam who.
Sam who?
Yeah. Yeah, Sam who?
Who? What?
I believe that your Twitch username is the same as your Twitter username, correct? Mr. Why Am I Here, who has tweeted only once.
He didn't reply to my tweet either.
Those of you who haven't heard the Twitter handle Sam Who with only one O has been squatted on
been
by
squatted.
Somebody
yes.
for many, many years. And they have only had one tweet, which is Why Am I Even Here?
No, it ends with a lull. You have to have the lull.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot about
just
the lull.
Just to rub salt in the wound.
Yes. Why Am I Even Here? LOL. Yes. And then and that's it. And
Don't
that was
a question mark.
That was years and years ago. They've not
yes,
tweeted
like
it since
six.
Then.
It is quite an old tweet.
Yeah. If anybody's listening that happens to work for Twitter
and wants to help poor Sam get a hold of his true username.
Wants to make things better.
Yeah.
We've got a thing you can do.
For just £2 a month, you too can sponsor a Sam Who.
Yeah. Oh man.
Look at this poor Sam Who over here.
So my personal algorithm for those kind of things is I add O's until the username is no longer taken. That's great.
Nice.
It works every time.
Wow. Why is it O's though? Why is it not like exclamation marks?
You should add the M's.
Usually there are some services that don't let you use exclamation marks. I never heard of a service that excludes O's from usernames.
I mean that'd be strange. Maybe they should in the future.
You could tack on like underscores. You could add on S's or M's. Those would also both be funny because then you become Sam Who or Sam
True, yeah.
Who. See? You have all sorts of options.
Thank you for phonetically sounding out what adding S's or M's would do to Sam's username.
I guarantee someone someday will listen to this podcast and not understand what those sounds would be in English. By me saying the letters.
That's fair.
So anyway, yeah.
Someone someday.
Someone should hopefully fix.
A leak joke. I saw that save.
Hopefully someone can fix that for Sam.
So yeah, we've had three requests, I think, so far today. We have please help Sam reclaim his Twitter account. We've had please help Ken's mentee find some junior Python developer work. And we've had, please go pester Sam as he writes Rust on Sundays.
Those all sound like great things. I need to get my live streams back up. I for about a year, I did a live stream every week, and then I stopped because I quit that job. I need to start doing that again.
Yeah.
So.
I live stream now fairly regularly, actually. I stream a very old video game called Guild Wars, and I go through and do very old things for fun.
I just yesterday got Elite Dangerous for my son and I, so...
Oh, that's quite the game, actually.
So I've heard. I haven't played it yet at all. He tried it a little bit yesterday and said piloting in it was just ridiculously complicated. But
yes, there are several like beginner guides that I would recommend.
I'm looking through the wiki right now. So
I believe
you get it on VR or did you get it on PC? Like just normal?
Just on PC. Right. We don't have any VR.
I'm told it's very, very cool in VR.
I have a Google Daydream. That's the only VR thing I have. I don't believe my phone and the Daydream will work well for Elite Dangerous. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to try it there, but I have a feeling it's not going to work.
I believe that the Elite Dangerous subreddit actually has a fairly solid beginner's guide and helps you rebind your keys so that you can fly effectively and everything, so...
I would recommend checking
that out, Ken, so that you and your son can fly in space.
I'm sure we will. We'll fly in space and things will happen. And then I'll get bored of it like I do every game that isn't RimWorld.
Isn't RimWorld? Oh, no.
RimWorld's about the only... It's the only game that just keeps me intrigued, man.
That's fair. I'm still playing Fortnite in droves. Yeah. It's okay.
Well, I think
with that said, though, that's our episode.
Yeah, that's our show.
You were about to get the outro, too, but...
I was. Do you want to do it?
We can... Yeah, well, I mean, we'll can tag team it.
We'll do half.
You
want to
do like a WWE thing, and I'll tag you in?
Sure. Tag me in.
All right. With that said, that is our episode for today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to us ramble about nonsensical things for 45 minutes. There were zero April Fool's jokes in this episode because even though we are recording the day before, we value your time and your listening and therefore did not make any April Fool's jokes. As per the usual, you can find all of our information on our website. Ken, what is that website?
That website would be wildtrue.fm. We're also on Twitter with the username WildTrueFM. We didn't have to add any O's. And go to the website if you want to see the show notes, the links, the places we've mentioned in this episode. They're all listed there. You can also find a link to each of our own Twitters and to our podcast Patreon if you'd like to be a supporter. Being a supporter gets you access to our Discord while we are recording. You get to listen in. You get to chat with us. You can give us ideas. Whatever. And then we have other levels that gain some other stuff as well. Go and check out the Patreon and see what you like there. So thank you again for listening, and we'll be back next time.